This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as head of the Communist Party over the weekend, and it looks like the Communist Party is in the process of being dismantled. We called William Taubman to talk about what that means and to discuss the new shifts in power between Gorbachev and Yeltsin. Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's written 5 books on the Soviet Union, including Moscow Spring. He edited and translated Sergei Khrushchev's memoir about his father Nikita. Taubman is now writing a biography of Nikita Khrushchev. I asked Taubman to describe the current status of the Soviet Communist Party.
It appears that it is suspended, at least on the territory of Russia itself. It's Yeltsin, who's the president of Russia, has closed down its newspapers. Gorbachev, the union president, has asked the Central Committee to disband itself. It's not clear exactly what is happening in every province capital, but essentially it is out of operation. Its physical premises have been sealed, barred, and sealed. I watch Soviet television here, which we get on a satellite dish live from Moscow, and I've seen countless pictures of the front doors of the Central Committee, the Moscow Party Committee, and others with tape across them and policemen on guards with guns.
Is that the democratic way of handling the dismantling of the party?
Well, you know, this is a very important question, and it is one that requires some reflection. I think that to Americans, the word party conjures up something like the Democratic or Republican Party. The Communist Party was never like the Democratic or Republican Party. It was a state within a state. And insofar as its apparatus and its leaders were instrumental in plotting this coup against the elected constitutional authorities, it was a criminal conspiracy within the state. Therefore, I think to ban the party, at least temporarily, while investigation proceeds as to its culpability or that of its leaders, is not as undemocratic as it might sound. But having said that, I would go on to add that I am nonetheless worried, because although I think the moves taken so far can be defended on the grounds I've just tried to outline, there is a kind of momentum that is developing here, and it seems to be leading in the direction of, at least for some people, in the direction of a kind of witch hunt in which innocent members of the party who played no role whatsoever in these events and who were simply going about their business and other jobs may be hounded and their pasts dredged up. And so in that sense, I take your question very seriously.
What are the signs that you see that this might be heading toward a witch hunt?
Well, I don't like at all the language that Boris Yeltsin has, or some of the language he's been using. He is a genuine hero, and his role in the events of this week was indeed admirable. But when he, in his funeral oration yesterday, when they buried the 3 young men who died trying to stop the tanks, he kept using the word enemy, vrag in Russian, enemy, enemy. And he also referred to the people who had made the coup as cockroaches. And this takes me back immediately to 1937. I'm in my book on writing about Khrushchev. I've been reading about that period again. And that's just the kind of language that was used over and over again by the Stalinists as they moved to arrest and liquidate people. Yeltsin, of course, is not doing that, and one surely hopes he won't. But he must know his history, and he should not use language like that as strongly as he feels.
Now, let me ask you about the Baltics and Moldavia, where the Communist Party has been outlawed. Are you concerned about witch hunts there, and what does it mean for somebody who is in the Communist Party?
Well, I am concerned about that. The democracy in the Soviet Union, naturally enough, means the chance for these republics to determine their own destiny. But the question is, how will they treat other ethnic groups within their own borders, and will they practice democracy within their own borders, even as they have claimed the right to do so? And one of the first tests will be how communists will be treated. Again, reacting to yesterday's news, I'm concerned because it sounds as if in the States, there may be an effort to call to account not just the Communist Party leaders who deserve to be arrested for their role in the coup, but it sounds as if they may try to dig up the past of anybody who had anything to do with the Communist Party, and that this will be a kind of ipso facto automatic evidence that they deserve to be persecuted. I hope this isn't so. And if they're true to their own ideals in these countries, it won't be. But in the heat of the moment, with their national patriotic passions roused, it would be all too easy to lapse into this kind of behavior.
Not that anybody has the answer to this, but how do you throw off the oppression of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union without entering into a witch hunt?
Well, I think you do the kind of thing that's been done in Eastern Europe. To some extent, it's been done in Latin American countries where oppressive military regimes have been ousted and replaced by democracies. You try to make sure that in the process of reducing the power or eliminating the power of the institution of the Communist Party and of punishing whatever of its leaders have committed actual crimes, that you don't go after innocent individuals whose only sin was to be a member of the party in a time when, I won't say almost everyone, because the party was never more than about 20 million people, but still an awful lot of people were members, including many of the very same people who will now be punishing the officials from the past. You try to make that distinction between institutions and guilty people and other innocent individuals. But it's very hard, because although I drew the analogy to Eastern Europe and Latin America, there's another analogy which will recommend itself to especially the Baltic states and others, and that is the Nazi Party in Germany. There will be people who will draw the analogy between the Nazis and the communists and will want to see something on a kind of domestic Nuremberg process, or the kind of purging or attempted purging of Nazi officials and others that took place in Germany after World War II.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more about recent happenings in the Soviet Union and what might lie ahead. My guest is William Taubman. He's a professor of political science at Amherst College, author of several books about the Soviet Union, including Moscow Spring, and he's working on a biography of Khrushchev. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is William Taubman. He's a professor of political science at Amherst College and has written extensively about the Soviet Union. You had an op-ed piece in the New York Times on Saturday that was about why you think Gorbachev should go. Why do you think he should no longer be the president of the Soviet Union?
Well, what I should say is that I think the events have moved so fast that although I think I was right on Saturday, on Monday, I'm not so sure. What I was trying to say in that piece was that if he did not change his tune, if he did not dissociate himself from the Communist Party, which he refused to do on Thursday and was only beginning to do on Friday, then he was not only a liability to himself in the sense that he would face increasing humiliation, but he was a liability for his country. His presence in the presidency would only further inflame the situation. On Saturday, he did break with the Communist Party. He resigned as its leader. He disbanded its Central Committee. And so in that sense, he took the step that he hadn't taken when I wrote that article. Given that, I think he might still be able to play a constructive role, because it was those very steps that he finally took on Saturday that will give him the basic credibility that he lacked on Thursday when he came back from captivity and started spouting the same old line. Now, the kind of constructive role I have in mind is as somebody who will attempt, and this seems to be what he's saying these days, who will issue warnings against witch hunts, who will remind people that there are innocent communists as well as guilty ones, who will attempt to see that the transition from the Soviet Union as it now exists to what looks like a confederation will proceed in a kind kind of peaceful and deliberate fashion. These seem to be the things he now sees as his aims, and if he can pursue them effectively, I think that would be to the good. Therefore, I even in my piece on Saturday, I didn't say he should resign right now. He said he shouldn't. He should declare that he would not run for re-election. Now I'd like to withdraw that and see how he behaves.
Do you think that Gorbachev is an important balance to Yeltsin now?
Yes, I do, although I think the weight of the balance is all on Yeltsin's side.
What is it about Yeltsin that needs the balance of Gorbachev?
Well, it's primarily his power. Yeltsin is accumulating power at an incredible rate, and I can understand why he's doing that. I mean, leaving aside his personal ambition, which I'll get back to in a minute because that scares me, he's acting to seize this opportunity. If you live in the Soviet Union, if you're a Soviet citizen, especially if you're somebody who's been in the power, the area of power, you know how relentless that Communist Party has been over these years, how powerful it's been, how widespread its tentacles have been, how resilient it's been. Now it is wounded, and it's dying, and this is the moment to move against it, and he is doing so. I say that's quite understandable. But power is power, and even if his intentions are worthy, to have all that power gathered in his hands would be ominous. And furthermore, there is evidence that he is a man who is not necessarily to be trusted with all of that power. He's a kind of impulsive man. He's an emotional man. He is a man who has behaved in the past with what seems to be irrationality. I have in mind some of his apparently drunken escapades. So he needs to be balanced. And if Gorbachev's the one, so be it. I hope there will be others as well.
Well, when you refer to his drunken escapades and irrationality, can you be more specific about the incidents you're referring to?
Well, I you know, there were charges that when he toured the United States, he was drunk at various times. That I certainly cannot speak to, having not been present, and he has denied it. The one incident that I did have some exposure to on Soviet television had to do with the time when he wandered into a police booth in a suburb of Moscow, all wet and dripping and apparently carrying flowers in his hands, and told the seemingly incredible story of how he had been kidnapped by some people who threw him off a bridge into a river. What I actually saw on Soviet television was the moment when the then Interior Ministry of the Soviet Union told what was their official account of what had happened, namely that the river was a creek, and it was just 3 feet below the path, and that the whole story that he had told seemed to have been made up. And on this day, he was called to the lectern to account for himself. This was at a meeting of the Supreme Soviet, and he kind of walked up sheepishly with his eyes cast down and said, "This is a private matter. I have nothing to say." The whole thing was bizarre. It was a bizarre incident, and his behavior that day was bizarre. And that's the kind of thing I have in mind. It would not really be worthy of comment. It's part of his private life. But for a man who is collecting the kind of power he's collecting, it's the kind of thing that one should take note of.
For those of us who haven't really kept up with his political actions of the past, what are one or two of the things we should know about Yeltsin to help put this past week's events into some kind of larger Yeltsin context?
Yeltsin comes from Siberia. He was a construction engineer. He worked his way up in the party to become the party boss of Sverdlovsk. He made a reputation for himself as a kind of forthright, straight-shooting type, and Gorbachev brought him to Moscow early on after Gorbachev took over to be the party leader of Moscow. And there he made a point, Yeltsin did, of getting out of his office, getting on buses, standing on lines, going to stores, examining the meat that was there or wasn't there. And he won a lot of sympathy from Muscovites for this kind of display of populism. But he also insisted on criticizing Gorbachev openly and some of the other people who allied with Gorbachev at the time, whereupon he was fired, Yeltsin was, as Moscow party leader. That very act of being fired was the making of the man, because he became, in the eyes of the population, somebody who had stood up and had been punished, undeservedly so, and had defended himself. He became a kind of martyr figure, but he was still alive, and he kept fighting. He seems to thrive on adversity. He seems to be at his best when danger is all about him. And so this week for him was really the perfect stage on which to display his talents. Another thing, he seems to have a gift for seeming modest, even when one wonders how modest he really is. I have in mind some of his language this week at the funeral oration, for example, for the young men who died in the barricades. He said he asked the families of the men who died to forgive him, he said, because he had not protected their sons. And then yesterday, when Gorbachev apparently offered him to award him, or wanted to award him, the highest medal of the Soviet Union, Hero of the Soviet Union, he declined. This kind of seeming modesty is very attractive under Soviet circumstances, where so many Soviet leaders have grabbed all the medals they could get as fast as they could. And I hope that this modesty is real, because it would be important for it to be on the part of somebody who's going to be as powerful as he will be.
You've talked about Yeltsin as the kind of political figure who thrives in adversity and who more than once has you know, been a martyr and then has risen from that position. What about his effectiveness as a policy leader, as someone who has a grasp of the difficult economic problems facing the Soviet Union?
Well, there's mixed evidence on that. Some of his associates who are in the Russian government, who've been thought in the West to be the most sophisticated and expert, have left him, saying or have quit his government, saying or implying that it was not all that much better than the Union government of Gorbachev, to which Yeltsin counterposed himself. But on the other hand, the fact that some of these people were there in the first place, and that others of them have remained, and that Yeltsin has gathered around himself a kind of brain trust of some of the most expert and sophisticated people in the Soviet Union, the best of the intelligentsia, speaks very highly for him. I know some of those people, and I've talked to some of them, and they say that he is aware of what the issues are, and that he's a good listener, and he can take advice from good people. So if that is the case, and it would appear to be, that's a very good sign, I think.
The Soviet system really bred conformity. You couldn't question or challenge authority. That's not the kind of psychology that really breeds democracy. Do you think that there's going to be just a lot of almost like personality change that's going to have to happen within the Soviet Union for people to really understand and thrive in a democracy?
I think that, I hope that will happen. I think it has to happen if the revolution, which has begun so hopefully this week, is to bear fruit. Not only 70 years of living under communism, but centuries of non-democratic rule before then, has produced a political culture of passivity, of fatalism, and it's not too strong to describe it as a kind of slave mentality. And that's very hard to change. The generation that grew up under that is going to find it very difficult to learn to act as free citizens. in some ways, the future really depends on the coming of a new generation. And one of the most hopeful things about the events of this week was that that new generation made its appearance on the barricades in front of the Russian government building, the White House, as they call it. I was listening yesterday, watching Soviet television, and the mayor of Moscow, who's a very, very articulate and intelligent man named Popov, said that for the first time, he saw 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, whereas up until now, the main supporters of reform in the Soviet Union have seemed to be people in their 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s. So the young people appeared, they mounted the barricades, they defended democracy, and as we know, three of their number died. One of them I found out yesterday from Soviet television was a young worker, an Afghan veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Another, interestingly enough, worked for a joint venture between Soviet Union and the West. And the third was an artist. And the three of them symbolize really the kinds of young people who came together at this crucial moment and on whom the future of the Soviet Union really depends.
William Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College and the author of several books about the Soviet Union. He's now writing a biography of Nikita Khrushchev. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.